France. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you first for inviting me for answering this question.
We also have Derek Wandera, a journalist and African affairs analyst. Thank you also for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's start off with Ronel there. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs, Ali Bagheri, says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has put developing ties with Burkina Faso on its agenda. What is the strategic importance of the ties between these two countries?
Burkina Faso, in Africa size, opening their ties with more cooperation, different cooperation, I mean different from Western country, from Indian country, from China, from Russia, it's good. It's a good news. There is a lot of interrogations that we have about this new partnerships. But for the Burkina Faso side, I think it's to give a new opportunities. Because I'm working on Burkina Faso issues, they are looking for partnership with Iran, something like an ideological connection more than economical connection.
In a meeting with Iran's envoy to Ouagadougou, the Burkinabe Prime Minister, Apollinaire Joachim Kailam de Tambela, called for expanding relations with Tehran. He said Iran is a country with great economic capacities and can therefore be a great business partner for Burkina Faso. Iran has expressed readiness to provide technical engineering services and nano-related technologies to Burkina Faso. These two countries can pattern in different sectors.
About the sectors that can Burkina Faso and Iran can be first the energy field. Burkina Faso have huge difficulty on its sovereignty and the energy sovereignty, and they need a partnership, and they know that Iran can be the right country with whom they can work with first. The second one can be a partnership about agriculture sector and mainly industrial sector. They are looking for what the different partnership before didn't get. And I think that when the Prime Minister Tambela called for more partnership with Iran is to assume that they need not only one partnership, I mean in one sector, but they need a real cooperation about elaborating for Burkina Faso a new way of development. To understand, in Burkina Faso, they just live now a hard economic situation since the COVID, and it gets worse day after day. So they knew two putches, and now they need a new, a new deal with the population, and to have a cooperation with strong sectors, as I said, energy, industry, and agriculture.
Since 2015, Burkina Faso has seen an increase of terrorist attacks by insurgents and Takfiri terrorist groups. The violence over the past 7 years has killed more than 10,000 civilians and soldiers and left more than 2 million people displaced internally. Now, let's bring in Mr. Wandera. How can Iran assist this Sahel region country in its campaign against foreign-backed terrorist groups?
The contribution of Iran in that country would be so pivotal in trying to secure the country, bring tranquility and peace in that country, support with security facilities, and I know that it would be very, very central in helping the country become secure, become peaceful, I think for the first time in a number of decades. And I fully support the idea that Iran should continue with that kind of working relationship with Burkina Faso to help the people who have been struggling with insecurity, lack of food, lack of homes because they've been displaced internally.
Now, I'll put the same question to Ranel. Do you think improved ties between Iran and Burkina Faso can have an impact in the war on terror?
Is to get in connection and to elaborate a regional policy security and not only a Burkina Faso security, because I think it will be a failure if you take this problem by the Burkina Faso side first. The second thing that Burkina Faso side, they are looking for, again, a cooperation. I mean, it's more, to reinforce the capacity and the capability of the army first, but not only. It's a question of internal policy, internal security, and the question of fighting against corruption inside the Burkina Faso priorities. Because the problem of terrorist attack now is not much about terrorists, that, you know, the apparition of different group of mafias.
Burkina Faso is rich in mineral resources and produces gold, zinc, copper, manganese, phosphate, and limestone in substantial quantities. In fact, it is one of the leading producers of gold in Africa. Ties with Iran can be a game changer for this country, which has remained poor while Western multinationals loot its mineral wealth.
The working relationship between Iran and Burkina Faso will be so helpful because, again, it is the same challenge. You know, African countries are naturally rich with so many natural resources. But the problem is some countries, whenever they come into the so-called trying to help, instead they loot those countries. And I know that Burkina Faso has suffered the same with some of the countries that have come in the same, in that kind of spirit. This coming in of Iran is certainly a game changer. Iran comes at a time where Burkina Faso needs that kind of partnership, which is pure, which is going to be helpful in terms of making the people, the locals first, the natives of Burkina Faso realize the impact of having such mineral resources in their country.
Over the recent past, we have seen a growing anti-Western and anti-French movement in Burkina Faso.
This anti-French and anti-imperialist movement in Burkina Faso is certainly the legacy of the country's famous and post-independence leader, Thomas Sankara. Now, this movement has commonalities with the Islamic Republic of Iran's policy of rejecting imperialism and domineering powers. Now, how can these commonalities be a major factor in boosting the bilateral ties between these two countries?
Is taken as a priority, and trying to help the fact that the country remains an independent country, looking at the kind of history they've had and the kind of issues that they've had, such a relationship will certainly be looking at the history and how the future of this country in terms of becoming, remaining sovereign is taken into maximum consideration. And I know that as the two countries come together, these are some of the kind of discussions that will be had.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up for today, but I'd like to thank our guests, Lavar Ranel, a research associate at the Foundation for Strategic Studies, and Derek Wandera, a journalist and African affairs analyst, for their incisive analysis today. Well, and that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
As global temperatures spike, there are fears that 2023 could be the hottest year on record. Early data shows June temperatures hitting record highs ahead of El Nino that experts say will have significant heating effect. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted the latest scorching heat wave has been burning the northern part of China over the past week, with high temperatures in multiple places surpassing 40 degrees Celsius, and meteorologists predict this year could be the hottest or second hottest on record, partly due to the El Nino phenomenon. Since June 13th, high temperatures above 35 degrees Celsius have been hitting multiple areas across China, including the central and western parts of North China Inner Mongolia Autonomous Region, the Beijing Tianjin Hebei region, the central and northern parts of central China's Henan province, the central and western parts of Shandong province, and the northern parts of Jiangsu and Anhui provinces, with a temperature in some areas exceeding 37 degrees Celsius, according to a report from China News Service. The high temperatures peaked recently in northern parts of the country, with the top 10 high readings appearing in cities in North China's Hebei province. Shijiangsong in Hebei became the first provincial capital city to exceed 40 degrees Celsius this year, and places such as Chicheng County and Fenging in Chende all set new records for the highest temperature in June. The National Meteorological Center, NMC, said that this heat wave so far has the widest range and strongest intensity this year, covering North China and regions along the Yellow River and Hohe River. The temperatures in some places have set new records. Southern parts of China also experienced a round of extremely hot days as early as May. Particularly on May 31st, the temperature in Guojia County in southwest China's Yunnan province surpassed 44 degrees Celsius. The latest round of heat wave in northern parts of China is mainly due to the gradual development and the strengthening of a high-pressure warm ridge located in northwest China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, which has been moving eastward and affecting areas including North China and the regions along the Yellow River and Hohe River. In the context of global warming, extreme high temperature weather has become increasingly frequent in recent years. According to the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, temperatures in Asia have been rising year by year, with a more significant increase observed after 2010. The entire world has been experiencing extreme temperatures. Researchers have indicated that with rising ocean temperatures worldwide and the onset of El Niño in the Pacific, 2023 could potentially become the hottest year on record, according to a report from China Science Daily. The previous hottest year on record happened in 2016. But recent temperature records suggest that temperatures recorded in 2023 may be approaching those in 2016. El Niño was formed and is expected to further contribute to the global warming process and bring about new peaks in global warming. The WMO released a report on May 17th, stating that due to the accumulation of greenhouse gases and the influence of natural El Niño events, global temperatures may reach record levels in the next 5 years, according to China News Service. There is a potential swift switch this year from the La Niña period, which lasted 3 years, toward the El Niño phenomenon, which has a warming effect on global temperatures and constitutes further temperature rises. Ma Jun, director of the Beijing-based Institute of Public and Environmental Affairs, told the Global Times recently. According to Ma, whether this year will become the hottest year in history will depend on factors such as the intensity of the El Niño event and the timing of its occurrence, and these factors will need to be closely monitored and studied to assess the potential impact on global temperatures. More meteorologists think if a strong El Niño phenomenon occurs at the end of this year, then next year will possibly be hotter, Ma said. In terms of the impact of El Niño on China, analysts of historical data by the National Climate Center have shown that during El Niño years, the regions that include the southern part of North China, the northern part of Central China, the central part of East China and the eastern part of Northwest China can experience higher temperatures in summer. Some areas may experience more than 30 days of high temperatures, according to China News Service. According to Ma, the El Niño phenomenon typically brings about a higher likelihood of flooding in the southern part of China and drought in the northern part. This year, it is important to pay attention to potential flooding issues in Yangtze River Basin, as well as the possibility of drought in the northern regions due to reduced rainfall and extreme high temperatures, which should be taken into consideration when assessing the potential impacts of El Niño on China. Besides, the early arrival of high temperature days was also reflected from the early release time of the high temperature heat stroke weather forecast this year. The Public Meteorological Service Center of the China Meteorological Administration, CMA, issued the first forecast for high temperatures and heat stroke for this year on June 15th, 13 days earlier than the average release date of most years. Guardian also noted, regardless of whether 2023 ends up the hottest ever recorded, scientists caution that the escalating impacts of the climate crisis are now starkly evident and will not be slowed until greenhouse gas emissions are radically cut. Natalie Manhold, an atmospheric scientist at Cornell University, said, "Without the strong emission cuts, the changes we are seeing are just the start of the adverse impacts we can expect to see." Natalie Manhold added, "This year and the extreme events we have seen so far should serve as a warning." Aperture.
In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like the dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America, and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water, and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further, because in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, oh, it's not so bad. When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea.
Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anane. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana. This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Councillor David Blackburn, if you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the asset tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste that have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa? Or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with it?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana. Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched as far as we can that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, and as I say, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. You happy? Is anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, if my security is going into administration, we'll be taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm. All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call Oda.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses, it's been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belen Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belen and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for €2. A fridge will yield up to €10 and a system unit €4. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, €10 million. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belen's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belen's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled. But D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering three continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors had been sold for between 50 cents and 2 euros a piece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo and Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling company shut down. But Mobo continue to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends 130 billion euros a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about 40,000 euros. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Annanay has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years, we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are working order, but some material sitting behind that that's not working order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use the resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. We've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. What about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity. Most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler, they'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new indictment for Donald Trump could be imminent after the former U.S. president announced on Tuesday morning, 18th of July, he had received a letter from Special Prosecutor Jack Smith identifying him as a target in the Justice Department's investigation into the January 6th insurrection. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump posted on social media on Tuesday, 18th of July, that he has received a letter indicating he is the target of a criminal investigation by a grand jury investigating attempts to interfere with the peaceful transfer of power after the 2020 election. Multiple sources confirmed to CBS News that the former president's post is accurate. And a senior Trump source said, Trump did receive a target letter on Sunday night to report to the grand jury, which was related to special counsel's 6th of January probe. The former president said on Truth Social, his social media platform, that he had received a letter saying he's a target of an investigation from special counsel Jack Smith on Sunday night. Trump said he was given 4 days to report to the grand jury. He repeated his claim that the special counsel is engaged in a witch hunt and criticized the investigation as a complete and total political weaponization of law enforcement. Jack Smith, according to sources close to witnesses, is building a sprawling case focused on how Donald Trump acted after he was informed by many of his allies, and especially his own lawyers, that claiming the election had been rigged could put him at legal risk. Jack Smith is also examining whether Trump criminally conspired to block congressional certification of the Electoral College votes by unlawfully applying what many of his attorneys told him was a baseless legal theory authored by constitutional scholar John Eastman, as a means of asking then-Vice President Mike Pence to not take steps to certify the election on 6th of January 2021, until further action was taken in several states. At the same time, the special counsel is also probing how Trump pressured Republicans in states to consider sending alternate slates of electors, declaring that he won Georgia and other battleground states. Jack Smith is also looking into any effort by Donald Trump to urge state officials and government and governors to make statements to make it seem like there was a basis for overturning Joe Biden's victories in those states. Former Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani and his efforts to assist Trump with his election fraud claims have been extensively discussed in questioning of witnesses, and the special counsel is building and expanding a chronology of Trump's pressure campaign with more evidence, according to sources. Giuliani has not received a target letter, according to his attorney Robert Costello. Attorneys for John Eastman also said their client had not received a target letter. Sources close to the investigation believe that Trump occupies the center of Jack Smith's investigation as a driver and instigator, not as an accomplice, though possible charges against the former president are not yet clear. The focus on conspiracy and fraud, however, suggests where the special counsel could be leaning. The special counsel's office has examined a meeting at the Oval Office on 18th of December 2020, where Donald Trump talked about bringing in attorney Sidney Powell as special counsel at the White House and seizing voting machines by an executive order. Earlier this month, CBS News reported special counsel investigators are digging into whether Trump believed the fraudulent claims of election fraud raised at the meeting weeks ahead of the 6th of January 2021, even though White House lawyers told him in person that night and afterwards the claims were not true. Several members of Donald Trump's inner circle have testified as part of the special counsel's probe, including former Vice President Mike Pence, White House counsel Pat Cipollone, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, top aide Stephen Miller, and a close ally, Steve Bannon. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, whom Trump asked in a phone call on 2nd of January 2021 to find 11,780 votes, just enough to give Georgia's electoral votes to the former president, has also testified in the probe. Jack Smith was appointed last November by Attorney General Merrick Garland to investigate not only the events surrounding the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, but also Donald Trump's handling of national defense-related documents since leaving office. In June, Trump and longtime aide Walt Noter were charged with multiple federal felony counts relating to the documents. A special purpose grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, earlier this year wrapped up its investigation into alleged attempts by Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has said she will announce decisions on possible charges relating to that investigation this summer. Donald Trump has also separately been charged in New York for alleged falsifying business records in connection to a hush money payout to film star Stormy Daniels. He pleaded not guilty back in April to those charges. Target letters are sent by federal prosecutors to individuals to inform them of their status in a criminal investigation. The Justice Department defines a target as a person as to whom the prosecutor or the grand jury has substantial evidence linking him or her to the commission of a crime, and who, in the judgment of the prosecutor, is a putative defendant. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. A new indictment for Donald Trump could be imminent after the former president announced on Tuesday, 18th of July, he had received a letter from Special Prosecutor Jack Smith identifying him as a target in the Justice Department's investigation into the 6th of January 2021 insurrection. Trump, who is already facing criminal charges in Florida for illegally hoarding classified documents from his presidency, and prosecution in New York for a hush money payment to a film star, said his attorneys handed him the letter as he was having dinner on Sunday night. Deranged Jack Smith, the prosecutor with Joe Biden's Department of Justice, sent a letter stating that I am a target of the January 6th grand jury investigation, and giving me a very short 4 days to report to the grand jury, which almost always means an arrest and an indictment, Trump posted on his Truth Social website. Jack Smith, who's also the prosecutor in the classified documents case, has been looking into Donald Trump's efforts to remain in office following his 2020 election defeat to Joe Biden, including the deadly 6th of January 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. It is unclear what the specific charges could be, but the letter gives Donald Trump until Thursday to exercise his option to appear before a grand jury in Washington. People who receive target letters from federal authorities are often, but not always, indicted. They are also usually advised by their attorneys to not take up invitations to meet with the grand jury, because any statements provided in that setting could be used to help build a case against them in the event that they're charged. The letter was, Donald Trump insisted, horrifying news for America, which he also claimed was an attempt by Joe Biden to arrest his number one political opponent. Donald Trump currently leads in polling for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination by a wide margin. Meanwhile, also on Tuesday, the lawyer who advised Donald Trump on overturning the 2020 election, John Eastman, indicated that he had not received a target letter from the special counsel, Jack Smith.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Who is Imam Hussein? Why did he launch an uprising? Imam Hussein's fight had two dimensions and can have two different fallouts. Nonetheless, both outcomes are good. One result was that Imam Hussein's, peace be upon him, could defeat Yazid's government and take power away from those who oppressed the people and devastated the fate of the people. So he could arrange things in an appropriate way. If this had happened, the root of history would have revolved. Another dimension was that if Imam Hussein could not, for whatever reason, achieve political and military victory, then He would not by words, but rather by blood, by resisting oppression, by a language that history will never forget, make his narrative flow like a perpetual and non-interruptible stream in history. This is what Imam Hussein did. Of course, for those who claim to be believers, if they had acted differently than what they did to Imam Hussein, the first case would have happened and Imam Hussein could have reformed the world and the hereafter at that time. But the people did not cooperate. The discussion about why and how the people did not act appropriately is a very long and exhausting discussion, which I elaborate to some extent.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Some years ago, under the title The Common People and the Elite, it included who failed to act properly, who was responsible for this behavior, how they behaved, and in which areas. I'm not going to mention this discussion now. So, as a result of some people's carelessness, the first goal was not achieved, but the second goal was accomplished. This is something that no power can take away from Imam Hussein, the power of going to the battlefield of martyrdom, sacrificing oneself and loved ones. The grand sacrifice that is so great that no matter how big the enemy is, it will appear small and unimportant before it. This bright sun will continue to emanate more light in the Muslim world day after day, till this light encompasses the whole humanity. Today, Imam Hussein is known to the world more than he was 5 centuries or 10 centuries ago. Today, the situation is such that when impartial intellectuals learn about the history of Islam and the story of Imam Hussein, they feel humble. Even for those who do not know anything about Islam, yet recognize this notion of freedom, justice, dignity, elevation, and lofty human values, Imam Hussein is an invaluable role model in seeking liberty and justice, in rising up against vices and evils, as well as in fighting ignorance and humiliation of mankind.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.